Hi, it's Radhika Jones, Editor-in-Chief of Vanity Fair. If you love digging into the week's political headlines, subscribe to Vanity Fair. Our reporters take you behind the scenes of some of the biggest stories from the campaign trail to the halls of Congress. Just for our Inside the Hive listeners, save 15% on a yearly digital subscription to Vanity Fair with promo code POD15. That's vanityfair.com, promo code POD15, for 15% off 1 year of all you can read, watch, and hear.
Welcome to Inside the Hive. I am your host, Nick Bilton. I have a very, very special guest with me today who I have known for a couple years now, who I wrote about and now has an incredible book out called Bad Blood, Secrets and Lies in a Silicon Valley Startup, which sounds as insane as the title. John Carreyrou, welcome to The Hive.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks for coming all the way out to L.A. to sit here with me and talk about this. Let's give, like, the... We're in an elevator. You just got in with someone who has no idea who Elizabeth Holmes or Theranos or this crazy story is. Can you just give us the elevator pitch as we go from floors 8 to 9?
Sure. So Elizabeth Holmes is a young woman who dropped out of Stanford in 2003 with a vision that she was going to revolutionize blood testing. And she created a company called Theranos, and her conceit was that she was going to create a device that was going to test tiny samples of blood pricked from a finger and be able to run the full range of lab tests on that tiny sample. And 10 years after she founded the company, she rose to fame and started gracing the covers of magazines and went live with her technology, her finger stick blood tests in Walgreens stores. And her company reached a valuation of $10 billion, and she had kept half of the equity. And so she was worth almost $5 billion, and she was the youngest self-made female billionaire in the world at that point.
And so now comes along John Carreyrou, and you are at the Wall Street Journal as a what's your title?
I'm an investigative reporter.
And covering?
I had covered for most of the previous 10 years medical issues, the healthcare system, the pharmaceutical industry. I'd done a series on Medicare fraud and abuse. And so healthcare was sort of my specialty.
Really kind of difficult to understand, mundane topics.
Often, yeah.
Yeah. So... So when was the first time you saw Elizabeth Holmes on a magazine or anything?
So she had really rocketed to fame in June of 2014 when she was on the cover of Fortune magazine, clad in a thin black turtleneck and wearing bright red lipstick and looking kind of deadpan at the camera, and with a very catchy headline that said, "This CEO is out for blood." I hadn't noticed her yet at that point, and she really showed up on my radar about 6 months later when Ken Auletta, the New Yorker writer, wrote a profile of her that was published in the New Yorker magazine in December of 2014. And I read that story on the subway coming back from the Journal where I work in Midtown Manhattan, heading back to Brooklyn, and there were a couple of things in that story that struck me as off. One of them was the notion that a college dropout who had basically two semesters of chemical engineering classes under her belt had dropped out and pioneered groundbreaking new medical science. I know, you know, that you can do that with computers and programming and
making photo sharing apps.
Right. And you know, people like Mark Zuckerberg taught themselves how to code on their dad's computer at 10 years old. But in medicine, that's not really how it works. You have to get the formal training, and then you often have to go to medical school, perhaps get a PhD, and then do years of research before you add value. You know, most Nobel scientists in medicine win that prize in their 60s after they've worked, you know, almost a lifetime. at what they do. So I thought that that was odd. But to be fair, I probably wouldn't have done anything with it if I hadn't gotten a tip several weeks later.
So it's funny. I remember reading that article and being a little, I know nothing about health reporting, but being a little slightly confused when Ken Auletta said to, and Ken is an amazing reporter. So I it's not to diss on Ken here, but there was a paragraph in there where Ken says, well, how does the machine work? And she says, well, there's a chemical reaction that happens when you put a chemical with another piece of chemical. And it's literally like a, like if you ask my three-year-old how, you know, dinner is made, it was his kind of response.
Right. He called it comically vague.
Yeah.
And that part of the story caught my eye as well. And I thought, you know, these are not the words of a sophisticated laboratory scientist. It sounded to me more like a high schooler describing a chemistry experiment. And so that was another one of the little nuggets in that story that struck me as odd. But again, you know, I'm pretty certain I would not have done anything with my intuition that there was something off here if I hadn't gotten a tip.
And so we're going to come back to the tip because I kind of want to get to some of the more salacious stuff first. But you get a tip and you start investigating this. And we're going to fast forward to the crumbling of Elizabeth Holmes and Theranos. And we'll come back to that moment in a bit. So today, Elizabeth Holmes, tell us where she is and what happened to the company.
Amazingly, Elizabeth Holmes, even though she's been now charged with fraud by the Securities and Exchange Commission, which, by the way, called the fraud a massive one, an elaborate years-long fraud, even though she's been charged with fraud, she reached a settlement in which she neither admitted wrongdoing nor denied it, and she paid a $500,000 fine, relinquished most of her stock and her voting stake in the company, and agreed to an officer-director ban for 10 years in a public company. A lot of people think that that's a slap on the wrist and that it's not commensurate with the magnitude of the wrongdoing here. But she is still CEO of Theranos. She conceded in an email to Theranos investors about a month and a half ago that the company would likely cease to exist by summer, by August.
Is she the only employee still there, or are there others?
There are about 20 employees left. She laid off another 100 employees about 2 months ago, and so there are about 20 employees left, and they're sort of turning the lights off at this point.
So yeah, what are those people doing? What is she doing?
So she, until that layoff announcement about a month and a half ago, she still had two drivers driving her around in a black Cadillac Escalade SUV that you know, was on the company's dime, as well as two assistants. And needless to say, you know, a lot of employees didn't think that was appropriate anymore. She is still nominally heading this shell of a company that's about to be liquidated. And she is now telling people that she is going to start a new company.
She's going to start a new company. Okay, well, before we get to the new company, so you come across this you get this tip, and you start reporting on what's going on with this company, and things, of course, don't add up. And you publish your first story in the Wall Street Journal, and everyone remembers the story. It's this big bombshell. And there was an immediate reaction from Silicon Valley, where a lot of people were like, this is total bullshit. This guy is just trying to destroy this poor woman who's working hard. At the time when that happens, what are you thinking? What's going on in your head? Are you like, did I pick the fight with the wrong person? Am I wrong? What are you thinking at that moment in time?
First of all, I was in New York, so I was on the other coast, and so I didn't fully get the full picture of that reaction from Silicon Valley. And I also kept my head down because I'd heard rumors among ex-employees of Theranos that there had just been an FDA inspection of the company, and I hadn't been able to confirm those rumors before that first piece was published. But the day that it was published, I finally made contact with an FDA source of mine who was able to confirm to me on deep background that an inspection had indeed taken place, and that the agency had taken away Theranos' little proprietary blood vial and effectively barred it from continuing to draw blood via finger prick, which was the whole point of the Theranos value proposition. And so I quickly was on deadline with that second day's story revealing that this FDA inspection had happened, and you know that the company was being crippled by the FDA's action. But as I was that evening, as I was standing over the shoulder of a page one editor at the Journal, Elizabeth Holmes came on the TV monitor because she had been
Jim Cramer.
That's right. She had been invited to sort of respond and rebut the Wall Street Journal piece on Jim Cramer's Mad Money. And so we paused what we were doing, turned up the sound on the TV, and she sort of played the part of the brilliant young tech founder who was under siege by a reporter who was in league with, you know, the entrenched industry that she was trying to disrupt. You know, and I can't remember her exact words, but it was something about how...
I remember. I remember because, so for people that don't know anything about Elizabeth Holmes took on a persona halfway through running this company that was a Steve Jobs-like persona, where she wore a black turtleneck and had her hair dyed a different color and so on. And she actually, as most wannabe Steve Jobsian people in the Valley do, she would quote him from time to time. And the first thing she said on Cramer was actually a quote that she took from Steve Jobs, which was, you know, sometimes they praise you and sometimes they come after you and whatever. So this is where you and I meet, right? So I see this story happening, and again, you know, had seen all these articles all over the tech press about praising her. And I remember the first time I saw her speak, and I remember leaning over to the person sitting next to me and saying, it was actually a guy, a producer in Hollywood, and saying that she's so full of shit. There's something about her story that doesn't add up. I didn't know what it was, obviously. But I did a piece for Vanity Fair about you doing this story and how the tech press had completely missed it, how they had just, oh, believe this person, written about her, and so on. Do you think, in looking at those pieces and knowing where we are today with the story, that the tech press should not have written about her because they didn't understand the technology, or should they? Was she just so manipulative and deceitful that they fell for it, or was it a bit of both?
Well, she her idol was Steve Jobs. She idolized Steve Jobs and Apple, and she really modeled herself after traditional Silicon Valley, which is, you know, the tech industry that is the descendant of the microprocessor industry from the 60s that became the personal computer industry, and then the internet boom in the 90s, and today it's smartphone apps and smartphones, and she really modeled herself in that tradition, and she got the press to see her that way. The press kind of lost sight of the fact that actually her product wasn't a smartphone or a smartphone app. It was a medical product that doctors and patients relied on to make important medical decisions. And in many ways, she should have modeled herself after perhaps the biotech industry, which is clustered in South San Francisco, north of the valley. And so the press sort of accepted the way she presented herself as a member of the traditional Silicon Valley tech scene. And that was for sure a mistake to just accept that at face value. I will say, though, that you can't entirely blame the tech press, because the first few publications, or at least two of them that come to mind that really put her on the map, three of them, that the first publication that gave her airtime was the Wall Street Journal. It was my newspaper, and it was an op-ed writer for the Wall Street Journal who interviewed her and published a friendly interview in September of 2013. And then the second big piece about her was in Wired magazine, which is a tech publication. The third piece, the piece really responsible for rocketing her to fame, was Fortune magazine. And the guy who wrote that piece was Roger Parloff, and he was not a tech reporter. He's the legal correspondent for Fortune magazine, and I tell the story of how that piece came about. And then Ken Auletta came a few months later and wrote the profile that got me to notice Theranos. And Ken is a great writer, but he's written mostly about media and technology and has not written about medicine. And so it was sort of a cross-section of journalists who gave her attention.
Yeah. When you look at the story, so let's just, you know, go through some like quick beats here about, in your book, you talk about some of the crazy things she did that were just unbelievably deceitful and lying. Can you just give listeners a few examples of some of those things?
Well, the prologue of the book is about a scene that takes place in November 2016 where the chief financial officer of Theranos finds out that the demos that they've been holding for investors, for prospective investors at the company's offices are bogus, that they're not real, and that the blood test results that the investors are given at the end of those demos are pre-recorded. And when he finds this out, you know, his jaw sort of drops because he was under the impression that these demos were real, and he was certainly giving the investors that he was bringing around that impression too. And so he goes to her office, to Elizabeth's office, and confronts her and says, you know, we really can't do this anymore. If the demos aren't fully real, we have to stop. And she turns from sort of happy-go-lucky to stone cold, icy, and says to him, you know, you're not a team player. You need to leave right now. And it's clear that she means not just leave my office, but leave the company, and he's just been fired. And so this takes place, you know, within 3 years of the company's founding, and it's about 7 or 8 years before she rises to fame. And my point in bringing it up is that it illustrates that she was behaving unethically from a very early stage in the company, and that, you know, then the bright red lines that she crossed got worse, because back then the company was still in research and development mode, and the blood, she hadn't commercialized the blood tests, and so patients' lives weren't at stake yet. But then she goes live with this pseudo technology in the fall of 2013. And actually, she and her boyfriend, Sonny Balwani, are using a Theranos device for only 12 of the tests on the menu, which contains 250 tests. And so the 238 other tests are run on commercial analyzers made by third parties, except they're not being run the way those manufacturers would like you to run them. They've modified them, and in particular, they're diluting the tiny finger stick samples to create more volume so that these commercial analyzers can test the blood. And that alteration of the blood by diluting it causes all sorts of problems and leads to unreliable results.
Did anyone die as a result of her deceit?
You know, I don't know the answer to that question. It's very hard to establish a correlation between a blood test result and a health outcome. What I do know is that a dozen patients have sued Theranos for consumer fraud, and they allege medical battery, and that's a putative class action that's winding its way through a federal court in Arizona. I also know that the company voided or corrected nearly 1 million blood test results, and I also know from ex-Theranos employees that the last laboratory director that Theranos had, who just recently left the company as part of the last round of layoffs, was arguing for every single blood test that Theranos ever returned to a patient to be voided. Wow. Because the quality control and the state of the lab were so bad that he argued we should just void everything. And so he was arguing for basically nearly 8 million blood test results to be voided. The company has only voided about 1 million.
So Elizabeth Holmes is a, when you look back from today back to when this all started, is essentially a serial liar. There's the story. Tell the story of the Walgreens with the fire alarm.
Oh well, that's a story that it didn't happen to me for one, and I learned about it after I'd actually finished my book. I learned about it through Twitter when I saw a piece written in the first person by a reporter who at the time had been working for NPR. And she started digging into Theranos a little bit and wanting to do a story on the company a while. I think it was a good 6 months before I ever started digging into the company. And she went, as part of her reporting, to visit the Walgreens store, I think it was in Palo Alto, and started asking patients questions. And some of the patients were getting venous draws, which is the medical term for when you draw blood the traditional way, meaning with a hypodermic needle drawing the tubes of blood. And she was not understanding why these patients weren't getting the vaunted finger stick test. And so as she asked more and more questions, suddenly the fire alarm went off in the Walgreens and everyone had to evacuate. And in hindsight, as she recounted in her piece recently, she suspects that perhaps someone from Theranos did that to sort of stop her from asking more questions and doing the story.
What's the craziest Elizabeth Holmes story that you discovered in your reporting?
Well, I mean, the most personally shocking to me was when she went to our conference, the Wall Street Journal's tech conference in Laguna Beach, about 10 days after my first story was published. And she did a Q&A with the journal's tech editor and proceeded to lie again and again. And that was stunning to me because she was in front of an audience, in front of a public audience, and it was also being streamed live on the Wall Street Journal website. And her lies in that interview were demonstrably false, and you could easily prove it. And regulators and investigators for the SEC have since shown that those lies that those were lies. I mean, one of them was she went on for about 30 seconds about how Theranos absolutely did not dilute finger stick samples before running them on commercial analyzers. And that lie was so egregious that one of my sources, who was an ex-laboratory director at Theranos, texted me as she uttered it and said, "Can you believe she just said that?" So seeing her lie live on the computer screen was something else. It was really stunning.
You're listening to Inside the Hive with Nick Bilton.
Let's take a break from all these lies and deceit in Silicon Valley for 1 second to talk about one of our sponsors, OneBlade. If you've ever had a professional shave from the barbershop, you know how it can change not only how you look, but also how you feel. It gives you that baby smooth skin and the confidence of knowing you look great. Now you can get that same barbershop feeling at home with the OneBlade razor. I got one last week and have shaved with it, and it feels like one of those $100 shaves you get in a fancy barbershop, except you're doing it at home by yourself. It's incredible. OneBlade will give you the best shave of your life with no razor burn or ingrowing hairs, and I can attest to that because usually when I shave, I get both things. They have this product that has been obsessively engineered to be the perfect weight and the finest materials, such as their ultra-high-grade German stainless steel. Each one is hand-assembled and serial-numbered, and every OneBlade is backed with a full 60-day money-back guarantee and lifetime warranty. So if you want to get one of these, or you want to get one for your father for Father's Day, go to this URL, onebladeshave.com/hive. That's oneblade shave.com/hive. That's H-I-V-E. And for Father's Day, you'll receive a free Yeti Rambler. It's one of those really cool coffee mugs with each razor blade purchase. Once again, go to onebladeshave.com/hive. Do you think so? It's one thing for someone to lie about, the number of downloads on their dating app, which I've experienced from my own reporting, and about, how good their photo filters are, or how many people even, you could even go to Zuckerberg not being honest in front of Congress about the privacy settings and things. But it's a whole nother thing when you have 8 million people getting their blood tested and their entire lives depend on these results being accurate. This is the question that I'm sure you get asked all the time, and it's the question I get asked all the time in relation to this story, is do you think that she is a sociopath?
So at the end of my book in the epilogue, I say that a sociopath is described as someone with no conscience. And I also say I'm going to leave it to the professional psychologist to decide whether Holmes fits the clinical profile. I think she absolutely has sociopathic tendencies, and one of those tendencies is pathological lying. It's I believe this is a woman who started telling small lies soon after she dropped out of Stanford when she founded her company, and the lies became bigger and bigger, that the gap between what she promised investors and where the technology was became giant. To the point of eventually becoming, you know, this massive fraud. And I think she's someone who got used to telling lies so often, and the lies got so much bigger that eventually the line between the lies and reality blurred for her. And it enabled her to kind of lose sight of what was a lie and what wasn't, and to therefore keep uttering these huge lies naturally.
Do you think that there's, and look, I mean, I know you can't necessarily speak for her, but do you think that there's a part of her that feels guilty for what happened and all the people's lives that were lost, I mean, jobs that were lost and so on, and lives that were affected, or does she feel more upset that she got caught?
It's the latter for sure. I mean, she has shown zero sign of, you know, feeling bad or expressing sorrow. Or admitting wrongdoing, or you know, saying sorry to the patients whose lives she endangered. I know from people who were working at Theranos until recently that she doesn't feel that she did anything wrong. To the extent that mistakes were committed, she feels like her entourage led her astray, and in that sense, I think she's throwing her ex-boyfriend Sonny Balwani under the bus. And she feels that the bad guy is me, that I'm the bad guy for having, you know, brought her company down. You know, one person in particular who left the company recently says that she has this deeply ingrained sense of martyrdom. She sees herself as sort of a Joan of Arc who's being persecuted.
That's insane on so many levels. All right, so let's take a little break from her and move to her boyfriend, Sonny Balwani. So Sonny and her meet in China, right, when she's on a school trip. How old is she at the time when that happens?
She's 18 when that happens. It's the summer between her senior year in high school and her freshman year at Stanford.
So Sonny, when he joins the company, is considered and called kind of by employees the enforcer. What are some of the things that he did that were enforcement-like?
He was incredibly arrogant and told people that, you know, he could read a book about, say, lab testing and 2 days later do their jobs, you know, better than they did them. Combined with this arrogance and this hubris, he was very intimidating in his demeanor, threatening, paranoid about Theranos' supposed technological advances and trade secrets leaking out. And he also fired people, anyone, you know, who started expressing concerns or qualms. He fired people so often that it gave rise to a new expression. When someone was suddenly no longer appearing at the office, people surmised that Sonny had fired them, and they would say Sonny disappeared so-and-so.
Sounds very mafioso-like.
Right. And then, you know, in addition to Sonny, it must be said that there was also David Boies, the famous lawyer who was Theranos' outside counsel starting in 2011. And he was like a scarecrow for employees because they figured that if they started raising questions to the board or internally to her or Sonny, or after they left the company, if they went to the press or to regulators, that the company would come after them, and that David Boies, this feared litigator, perhaps, you know, our country's most famous attorney, would be the one coming after them.
And Boies came after you when you were writing your first story. Was he in on the lies? Did he know that it was all made up, or did he not?
You know, I don't know the answer to that question. I suspect that he did not. or at least that he had a very cursory and partial understanding of what was going on in the Theranos clinical lab. I don't think he realized that when I first started interacting with him and he came to our offices at the Journal in June 2015 and with his associates from Boyce Schiller and Heather King, who was an ex-Boyce Schiller attorney who had just become general counsel of Theranos, and when they acted very aggressively toward us, essentially, you know, threatening us with litigation, I don't think he knew the extent of the shenanigans in the lab at that point.
The thing that I have such a hard time understanding is that there are, at one point in time, close to 1,000 employees there.
That's right.
And it, you know, if I work for a company, you know, a Vanity Fair, there are a few dozen people. Like, if one person is you know, stealing something or making something up, or it would take about a few days for everyone to know what was going on, especially if everyone's job relied on that person and vice versa. It was all so intertwined. You've got a company at Theranos where you have the lab results and the blood testing and all right. these things that are so intertwined. Do these 1,000 employees not know what's going on?
A lot of them didn't know, Elizabeth and Sonny really kind of kept the company or part the different parts of the company compartmentalized in silos. And you know, the headquarters, the different parts of the headquarters building in Palo Alto, you needed key cards to get into certain parts, and you certainly needed key cards. In fact, in the last iteration of the lab in Newark, California, which was where Theranos' big manufacturing facility was located across San Francisco Bay, you had to be an authorized employee of the lab, and to enter the lab, you had to have your you put your fingers against the fingerprint scanner. So no one who was not a lab employee was allowed to go near the lab. And so tons of employees, when my first story came out, I would say a majority of the company didn't realize that what I was reporting was true because they hadn't been allowed near that lab, and they didn't know that the Edison machine only was used for a handful of tests, and that Theranos had hacked these Siemens machines and modified them to accommodate small samples.
This is the point where this is when I wrote the piece about you and Theranos and Elizabeth Holmes in the magazine, and the lead of the piece, which is I think maybe my favorite part of the story because I get to say the words I'm about to say, is that your piece comes out and Elizabeth Holmes and Balwani call an all-hands meeting in the cafeteria, and they talk about how the piece was bullshit and made up. And it's Balwani, I believe, if you correct me if I'm wrong, who starts a chant where he says, "Fuck you, carry you," and then everyone starts chanting, "Fuck you.
Fuck you, carry you." And and actually, there was a history and a pattern of chanting "fuck you" at Theranos. It had happened several times before. The previous time it had happened had been 3 months before, when Theranos had gotten good news from the FDA, which was that its herpes test off a finger stick sample had been approved by the agency. And Elizabeth and Sonny were very proud and defiant during that meeting in the cafeteria in July of 2015. And at the end of the meeting, Sonny led employees in a fuck you chant. And at that point, the fuck you chant had been directed at LabCorp and Quest, the dominant players in the lab industry, and it was sort of Sonny and Elizabeth's way of thumbing their nose at the competition. When my piece came out three months later, and the fuck you chant was chanted again, the version of the story that I was told is that a senior hardware engineer asked Sonny to lead them in a chant without specifying what the chant was, and of course everyone knew what he was talking about, and Sonny was happy to do so, and at that point they started directing the fuck you at me.
And then they made as the reporting continued, they made a video game, a Space Invaders video game with your head as one of the invaders you had to kill. Was that right?
That's right. And so the Theranos employee who programmed that game and actually sent me a copy recently wanted me in media interviews, if it came up, to specify that Sonny and Elizabeth weren't a part of it, that they hadn't ordered him to do it, that he did it of his own initiative. And this was back in the spring of 2016 when he and many other employees still felt that my reporting was wrong, that I was a journalist who was just bent on bringing this company down. And they had a party during Memorial Day week, and he created this game to sort of boost the morale of his colleagues in Newark, California. And so it's a version of the Atari game Space Invaders, where you have my head that falls from the top of the screen, so I'm the invader, and then you have the machine gun at the bottom that is the mini lab, the Theranos blood testing device, or at least the last version of it, and then the mini lab is spewing these bullets, and the bullets are the nanotainers, the little blood vials that Theranos used to collect fingerstick blood.
While I'm sure that Sonny Balwani and Elizabeth Holmes didn't tell the employee to make it, I'm sure they found a lot of glee in seeing it being made.
Well, I think in a way it spoke to how they treated dissent.
Yeah.
You know, and how they coached their workforce to treat dissent. They were always right, and any doubts emitted were seeded by competitors or people, you know, who were out to get them. It was sort of an us versus them mentality at all times. I think the problem is that a lot of employees didn't realize the cheating that was going on in the lab. And so Elizabeth and Sonny were leading this culture of us versus them, while knowing fully that we are cheating and we're cutting corners and we're putting patients in harm's way.
This is Inside the Hive with Nick Bilton.
So a few weeks ago, we had a sponsor on the show, Away Travel, that sells suitcases. I went along to awaytravel.com/hive and got my discount code and ordered a new suitcase. And I have to say, it is incredible. It's amazing. It's truly the greatest thing I have purchased in the last couple of years. And I'm not over-exaggerating when I say that. Sure, you're probably saying to yourself, wait, I have a suitcase. How good could a new suitcase be? You have no idea. One of the things that they're able to do is they're able to cut costs by cutting out the middleman, because they sell directly to you on the interwebs. They have several different sizes, including the carry-on, which is approved to fit above your cabin seat on an airplane. They have the bigger carry-on, the medium, the large for those of us that are going away for a month or two to try to get away from the Trump administration. They also have a kids one, which I bought for my little three-year-old, and he loves it. He walks with it around the house all the time. The suitcases have a patent-pending compression system, help for overpackers, just like me. They have four 360-degree spinner wheels that guarantee a smooth ride. That may sound like it's not a big deal. Trust me, when you are running through the airport, this suitcase is like a Mini Cooper driving alongside next to you. You can push it, you can pull it, you can twizzle it. The best part of these suitcases is that they have a built-in cell phone charger to charge your phones, your tablets, your Kindles, whatever it is. You can charge your phone 5 times on one single charge of this little suitcase charger thingamajig. I was in DC last week, and I found myself rushing through the airport with my phone almost dead. I felt like I was James Bond with some secret MI6 gadget that no one else had. They give you a 100-day trial, so you can live with the suitcase, vibe with it, travel with it, Instagram it, whatever you want. And if you don't like it, you'll be able to return it for a full refund. But I can assure you that you will love it. Right now, Away Travel is offering a special discount for listeners of Inside the Hive. You get $20 off a suitcase when you visit awaytravel.com/hive and use the promo code HIVE during your checkout. Once again, you get $20 off your suitcase when you visit awaytravel.com/hive and use the promo code HIVE. There are so many to choose from. They come in all different shapes and sizes, all different materials, and you can charge your devices on the go. Once again, $20 off awaytravel.com/hive. When you kind of look back at all of the reporting and these stories of the video games and the chants and the lying on stage and on TV and everything, which part of the story would you say is the most jaw-dropping, and which part of the story, it's a two-part question, would you say for you when you were kind of back doing all this reporting, there was the moment where you were just like, holy shit.
I mean, I think one of the most egregious episodes for sure was when Tyler Schultz, who was one of my confidential sources, and for those who haven't followed the Theranos saga, he was the grandson, is the grandson of George Schultz, the famous former Secretary of State during the Reagan administration, who crafted the Reagan administration's foreign policy and is credited by many with essentially winning the Cold War. He's in his 90s now, but he remains a very well-respected figure in Republican circles. And he happens to live right off the Stanford campus, and he's always been passionate about science and was introduced to Elizabeth in 2011, joined her board, and became one of her biggest champions. And his grandson came to work at Theranos for 8 months in late 2013 and early 2014, and became convinced that the company was committing fraud and tried to alert his grandfather to it. His grandfather wouldn't believe him, so he had ended up leaving. And then a year later, when I started poking around, he and I made contact, and he became one of my confidential sources. And when I started confronting Theranos with what I'd uncovered in my reporting in the spring of 2015, they started counterattacking. And one of the things they did is they ambushed Tyler at his grandfather George's house with two Boies Schiller Flexner lawyers who were hiding upstairs, and who proceeded to come down, and one of them in particular by the name of Mike Brill really was very aggressive and kind of like an attack dog, telling Tyler that he knew that he was a source of mine, and that he had to admit it, and that he had to signed documents, you know, recanting, and Tyler had to withstand this enormous pressure in the presence of his own grandfather and his step grandmother. And there was another scene again at the house the next morning, and you know, these attorneys were acting at Elizabeth Holmes's behest. She was absolutely aware of what was going on, because after the confrontation that evening, when George Schultz finally ushered those two lawyers out of his house, he called her and he said, that's not what we'd agreed upon. We'd agreed that Tyler would just be presented with a short statement reiterating that he would abide by his confidentiality obligations, and instead you essentially ambushed him with these very aggressive lawyers. And so Elizabeth fully knew what was going on. Not only did she know what was going on, she directed these lawyers to behave the way they did. Thankfully for me, Tyler got legal representation and then continued to endure many more months of pressure and threats. At one point, I learned that one of the lawyers, Mike Brill, threatened to bankrupt his entire family if he didn't sign the documents that Theranos wanted him to sign. Tyler never caved, and in large part thanks to him, I was able to go to press with my investigation in October 2015.
Did Tyler and his grandfather make up, or?
So I'm going to be a little coy, but a good source of mine tells me that recently there was a gathering at the Schultz household, at George Schultz's house, and that George told members of the family he had read the SEC charges and had discovered the magnitude of the lies and of the deception, and that he'd had no idea that any of this was going on, and that he now realized that Tyler had been right all along, and he said that Tyler was a hero.
When you think about the board, this was, to me, I remember when I first read your story and looked at the board, totally scratched my head. It was a dozen white men, all incredibly successful in their time, Henry Kissinger and so on. Were they, you know, when I think about those
Jim
people,
Mattis, our current Secretary of Defense,
Jim Mattis, yeah.
Sam Nunn, Bill Frist, William Perry, Secretary of Defense under Clinton, George Schultz, Admiral Ruffhead.
These are not they're smart guys. I mean, among the smartest. Was the wool being pulled over their eyes too, or were they just not asking the right questions? Did they just believe everything she told them? Are they guilty here too?
I mean, the wool was being pulled over their eyes. They had no expertise whatsoever in medicine or laboratory science.
And that was intentional on her part.
And that was intentional on Elizabeth's part. She recruited, you know, she was after two things. She was after people who wouldn't be able to ask the right questions that, you know, would ferret out that she was lying. But she was also after their credibility. And these were all, you know, former statesmen or military commanders with unbelievable resumes. And so she was looking for the credibility that came with their reputations. And it worked because, you know, some investors like the San Francisco hedge fund Partner Fund Management, which invested $96.1 million in Theranos in early 2014, they tried to do some due diligence and they were outright lied to. And so the lies, you know, led them astray. But it must also be said that they were impressed by the makeup of this board. They thought, you know, these larger-than-life figures, how could anything untoward be going on at a Silicon Valley startup with that kind of a sterling board? Not to mention the fact that guarding the shop is, you know, the country's most famous attorney, David Boies.
One of my sources, back when I did the magazine piece, had said that Elizabeth knew how to work these older men in a way that was pretty impressive. What did she do?
Well, you know, this is sort of a controversial topic nowadays amid the Me Too movement, but it's undeniable that her marks, again and again, were older men. It started with Channing Robertson, her Stanford Engineering School professor, who she persuaded to back her when she founded Theranos in late 2003, early 2004, and who joined the board of the company, accompanied her to pitches with VCs. Then she charmed Donald L. Lucas, who was a pretty famous venture capitalist who, among other things, groomed Larry Ellison and helped him take Oracle public in the 80s. Then he started developing Alzheimer's disease in 2010, 2011, at which point she met George Shultz, and she wrapped George around her finger. And he then introduced her to all his buddies at the Hoover Institution, the think tank on the Stanford campus. And she wowed them. I don't, you know, necessarily think that it was a sexual thing by any means. I think it was a combination of her intelligence, a combination of her charisma, her bold vision, her energy, all of that in one package led these men to really believe in her and want to join her company's board. Of course, it helped that she also granted them a lot of shares of Theranos.
What did they get? How much did they get for?
They each got several million dollars worth of shares,
which are worth several million pennies,
or worth
nothing,
zero today. Yep.
I'm going to go back to this because I still can't get my head around it. When she's lying to all these people, and she at the same time thinks that she is like a Joan of Arc martyr, how does she reconcile those two things? It's so hard for me to understand someone who is out there literally blatantly lying, and yet she thinks that she's the victim.
Well, you know, it goes back to her modeling herself after Jobs and after the traditional Silicon Valley tech industry. There's as I say in my book, there's a term that was coined in the early 80s, vaporware, that describes either computer software or hardware that's announced with great fanfare by a company and then is either never delivered upon or is delivered really without the great features that were promised. And a lot of companies, you know, engaged in this practice in the history of Silicon Valley. And a lot of tech entrepreneurs engaged in the practice and kind of engaged in fake it until you make it. And Steve Jobs, you know, was one of those guys.
Completely.
But it's it's more okay to do it in tech where mostly you have got a product revolving around software. So when you get your new iPhone or the latest version of iOS on your iPhone, there's often a bug in it, and then the bugs get fixed, and the next downloads, and you know, our lives aren't really interrupted or altered by that, and we've learned to accept it. But you can't do that with medical devices. And I think, because the product is used to make health decisions and lives are at stake, I think Elizabeth either conflated the two to the point that she completely lost sight at an early stage that her product was actually a medical product, or she just refused to realize that the end user was not, you know, an iPhone customer or a software customer, but a patient. And yet, at the same time, when she was at the height of her fame, she often, said that her invention was going to revolutionize healthcare because it would allow for earlier diagnoses, and because people would get their blood tested more often because it was easier and cheaper, and therefore fewer people would have to say goodbye to loved ones too soon. And so she appealed to that empathy. She played on that chord, and I think it was just a canned sort of rehearsed catchphrase, and she never really had any empathy, because otherwise how could you and let happen what happened?
She let's do a little quick game before we wrap up here of where are they now. We're going to end with Elizabeth. Sunny Balwani, her co-conspirator and boyfriend at the time, now ex-boyfriend.
Right. So for a while he was he went underground, and a lot of ex-employees of Theranos speculated that he had left the country to elude investigators, because there's a criminal investigation that's still ongoing, spearheaded by the U.S. Attorney's Office in San Francisco. And he was still hanging around Palo Alto and Atherton, where he owned a big house. And I was able to confirm that when I learned from Tyler Schultz that Sonny had appeared at his deposition in the partner fund litigation, the San Francisco hedge fund that had invested almost $100 million in Theranos, sued it for fraud. And Tyler was deposed in that case, and Sonny showed up for the deposition, which is very unusual. And
showed up just to watch?
It was clear that he was there to try to intimidate Tyler. And he's since done that in other strands of litigation involving Theranos. And so he's now done it several times.
Do you think he'll go to jail?
I think that I know, based on what my sources are telling me, that the criminal investigation is very advanced, that criminal indictments of Sonny and Elizabeth are a distinct possibility, if not, you know, a real likelihood. And then, of course, the government will have to prove its case if it goes to trial. But if they do, then yeah, I think those two could be looking at prison time.
David Boies, is he still involved in any way, shape, or form? Or
no, David Boies stopped doing legal work for Theranos in the spring of 2016. Elizabeth stopped listening to him and started.
What advice was he giving her that she was going to?
I'm told that by that point it had been, you know, 8-9 months after my investigation had come out, and he had done enough research and his firm had done enough interviews and gone over documents to realize that Theranos was liable for some lies to investors, and so he felt that the company should proactively go to the SEC and try to negotiate a consent decree. But Elizabeth Holmes at that point had stopped listening to him and had hired a new law firm, WilmerHale, which replaced Boies Schiller Flexner, and that is actually still the main law firm that today Theranos is using. He subsequently left the board of Theranos, I think it was in March or April of 2017, so he's cut all ties with Elizabeth Holmes and Theranos.
Do you think he regrets the things he did? Has he ever apologized to the way he treated you? Or
I have reason to believe that that he regrets his involvement with Theranos and that he now realizes that it was a fraud. And the most concrete hint that I have to point to is a quote he gave to New York Magazine, which wrote a story about my book about a week ago. And in that, in his quote, he called my reporting important and the fact that I had uncovered this scandal important work. And so I took it as a tacit admission that he was acknowledging I had been right all along.
That must be nice, considering that he came in and threatened to destroy your entire life in the Wall Street Journal newsroom a few years earlier.
It was vindicating. And the other part of his quote, he said that I was over-dramatizing in my book the events. And I can tell you that I didn't over-dramatize anything.
I don't believe you over-dramatized a single solitary word.
I told it exactly as it happened.
Yeah, completely. All right, so let's wrap up with my favorite sociopath, Elizabeth. Where is she now? Is she ever going to go away? And what happens? Because she doesn't seem like she's ever going to go away.
So in the spring of 2016, about 8 months after my first story came out, she was on the cusp of being banned from the laboratory industry. And so she realized that someone had to pay, and there had to be some consequence. And so she threw Sonny under the bus. She fired him, and she broke up with him. She moved out of the big house they'd been living together in Atherton, and moved to a rental in Los Altos Hills. I'm told she's actually now in San Francisco, that she recently moved to a new apartment in San Francisco. But amazingly, she is still running Theranos, which is a shell of what the company it had been. It long ago vacated the expensive headquarters just off the Stanford campus that it had occupied on Page Mill Road. And now the two dozen employees left work in Newark, California, in this manufacturing facility that Theranos owns, or leases, rather. And, the countdown is on for when the company goes bankrupt, and I expect that to happen by early August. And I'm looking and waiting to see what happens with the criminal investigation. It's possible that federal prosecutors will announce something either before then or shortly after.
Did you ever talk to Elizabeth for the book?
No, I tried sporadically. I obviously, before we ever published my first story, I tried to speak to her for 5.5 months before we went to press with that story, and then again sporadically went back and asked for interviews. She always denied me an interview, and in the fall of 2016, when I went on book leave, I tried again, and she just wouldn't grant me an interview.
So last two questions. One is, when you think about her and the lies and the way she kind of came after you, and the way she treated her employees and the patients and so on, do you get angry? Is there a feeling of just like bitter anger towards this person and what this person has done in the universe?
There was a little bit of that, I'd say, while I was reporting the story, and then in the immediate aftermath. What I feel,
because I get angry just hearing you tell these stories.
I feel proud that, thanks to my work, that the company was driven out of the lab testing business, and it had to close its two labs in October of 2016, and from that point on, it could no longer affect the health of patients. That was a really a big victory for me, and for the public health. I still part of me still feels that the right punishment to be apportioned given the crime and the wrongdoing, there needs to be that criminal charges do need to be filed, and that there needs to be a criminal trial, because like many, I feel that the SEC resolution was really a slap on the wrist. I mean, fining her $500,000 and banning her from being a director or officer in a public company for 10 years. I mean, she's not even running a public company. She's still running a private startup. And she, based on what she's telling friends and colleagues, she's about to start a new company.
Do you know what the new company is going to be?
I don't know any details about it, but I know that she's told several people that she is going to incorporate and start a new company.
All right, so here's my last question. Imagine for a moment that I am Elizabeth Holmes and you're sitting across from me, Elizabeth Holmes, and you get to ask one question. What would it be?
How could you rationalize what you did? And namely, how could you rationalize lies that put patients' health in jeopardy?
And her response would be, what are you talking about? I didn't do anything. John, this is it's been fascinating, as always. I encourage everyone to read the book. It reads like a murder mystery thriller. You can't put it down once you pick it up. The title is Bad Blood, Secrets and Lies in a Silicon Valley Startup. John, where can people find you on the internets?
They can find me on Twitter at John Carreyrou with the J and the C capitalized. They can email me. Do people give out emails on this podcast?
You can. Most people don't. You can do whatever you want.
firstname.lastname@wsj.com, and they can find my book in any bookstore near you or on Amazon.
Or barnesandnoble.com or wherever you like. It is a great book. It's really, really a fascinating read. Just going to wrap up here. Thank you to my guest, John Carreyrou, and of course to John Kelly, my editor of Vanity Fair. If you enjoyed this conversation, be sure to listen and subscribe to other great episodes of Inside the Hive with Nick Bilton. You can find these on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, or anywhere you get your podcasts. And don't forget to leave a review while you're there. Will you tell these people to leave a review?
Leave a review.
A five-star review. How important are reviews for books, too?
Oh, they're crucial.
Yeah, you got to leave a review, people. It's really important. And if you don't have anything nice to say, forget it. Don't leave a review at all. Thanks to the folks at Cadence 13 for their production work, and thanks to my sponsors, Away Travel and OneBlade. Please support them the same way you support this podcast. I will see you or hear you all next week.
I'm Alex Schwartz.
I'm Nomi Fry.
I'm Vincent Cunningham, and this is Critics at Large, a New Yorker podcast for the culturally curious.
Each week, we're going to talk about a big idea that's showing up across the cultural landscape, and we'll trace it through all the mediums we love. Books, movies, television, music, art.
And I always want to talk about celebrity gossip, too.
Of course.
What are you guys excited to cover in the next few months?
There's a new translation of the Iliad that's coming out, Emily Wilson. Really excited to see whether I can read the Iliad again, whether I'm that literate. The jury is out.
I can't wait to hear Adam Driver go again in an Italian accent in Michael Mann's Ferrari.
He can't stop.
I mean, and bless him. I can't wait.
Molto bene.
Molto bene.
We hope you'll join us for new episodes each Thursday. Follow Critics at Large today, wherever you get podcasts.
You really don't want to miss this.
Don't.
Don't miss this.
Don't miss it.
See you soon.